Welcome back to UAP Studies Podcast. This is an episode that I've been looking forward to for quite some time. Michael, I know you are meeting actually Richard and Tracy for the first time. This is the first time I actually had a conversation live with Tracy. We talk on Facebook every once in a while, but I've never got to talk to her in person. So it's awesome to have the Dolans here today. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited because I've been in this topic for about 4 years now, and I'm finally getting to see some of the like very first faces that I saw say anything in like a UAP documentary, and I thought, oh, that makes sense. That's a thoughtful, sort of knowledgeable perspective that you're bringing, and Richard Dolan is definitely one of those people, so it's an honor to have him on the podcast.
Thanks very much, guys, and we're both happy to be here doing this together. This is not an everyday occurrence.
No, it's pretty rare, actually.
I would assume that people would want the married couple that do this work together to be on together. That's weird.
Well, maybe there'll be more in the future, but no, we just did one together with Alexis Brooks, who's a good friend of ours, a few weeks ago. That might have been the first, so this might be the second that we've done as guests.
Since we had our show together. Yeah, it's been a while.
Well we're honored.
We like it too. I mean, it's fun. We're kind of into slightly different things, but it all overlaps and it's fun.
And opposites attract. That's a thing too. I think you know, as a married couple, if you're open to ideas and subjects and good conversations, which obviously you guys are both great conversationalists, you have nothing to run out to talk about. You can always talk about the house plant behind you if you want to, and that's not a problem.
I would say it's like complements attract. I mean, not quite opposites, but we do complement each other very nicely. Tracy brings things to the table that I don't do, and vice versa. And so we feel like we really fill the gaps.
The overlap and differences in your interests? Like, how would you characterize them, Tracy and Richard?
Our differences, overlaps
and interests. Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, when I met Richard, I was already deep into all of this. You know, I had probably come more from just a lot of phenomena was entering my world growing up, and I did not understand what was going on to me. So I'm kind of coming from more of an experientialist side, where I wasn't thinking for years about ET, UFO, things like that. That whole area scared me, you know. But I was trying to work out what was happening, because the reality that had been explained to me and reinforced through degrees and everything was not what and my experience had a total conflict, you know. So I was on this mission to try to figure out, first of all, am I okay? You know, part of the reason for my psych degree, you know, I wanted to study the mind and know its reaches and where I stood within that. And I wanted to make sure, honestly, that I was psychologically grounded and stable, because of all these things that were happening. So yes, for me, it's very coming from the experiential side. Then it sort of ventured more into some experiences that I had that opened the ET UFO door. And
also got you to UFO conferences, which is where we met.
That's right.
It was meant to be.
Yeah. So,
To answer, we do have a lot of overlap. We're both interested in, Tracy's gotten very conversant with UFOs in general, abduction phenomena. She did a whole independent study of that, interviewed many, many abductees. We talk about AI, future tech all the time. Mm-hmm. Tracy does a lot of that, and I am interested. So there's a lot. And then we have different focuses. I mean, Tracy is more focused on consciousness issues, but not to the exclusion of me. Like, I'm interested in that as well, frankly. We just did an event last weekend, which was all about consciousness, and I loved being part of that. But then, you know, I will focus more on just not only UFOs, but geopolitics, international politics, history. But I find, you know, my wife has, this wasn't her interest in the beginning of our time together, but I will have to say she's come a long way. So we overlap in a lot of ways.
And I think at the bottom of it, we're both insatiable for knowledge. And that
probably like your listeners.
Yeah. And you guys, of course, it just propels you forward. And we're always curious. And of course, these areas are not exclusive. they, of course, they overlap completely, right? And
I think the more you find out about any one of them, the more you see that there's sort of causal and interesting thematic connections between them. So that's, I'm sure that's a fertile ground for conversation and relationships and all sorts of work together.
That's looking like a web. And the more you learn, the more everything's interconnected. We've got the best early morning coffee cup conversations we could imagine. We should record them more because they're pretty good.
Well, actually, that was a big part of our member site in the beginning. We would have coffee talk and we would actually be sitting there in our robes having
That's a good idea. I just thought,
I got to record this guy. I got to capture these rants. I originally wanted to call them Richard's rants. I just thought these are gold. People would love to hear this because he's just unfiltered, you know? So that's kind
Richard's nuggets. You know what I mean?
I think
the best conversations with my wife in the bathroom. I don't know why. she'll always come in. Yeah, she'll come in and ask me like, hey, what do you think of this? We'll get a big debate. It's like 20 minutes go by. We're still in the bathroom arguing over something stupid. But it's, you know, but that's the thing. I always tell people too, you have to focus in this field. You have to focus on specific things. Michael is more on the philosophy side of things. Like what is the involvement of disclosure? What does that mean? You know, and we need philosophy in this.
Yes, mm-hmm. we do.
As much as we need science, it's, if not more, because it reshapes our thinking, our understanding of our place in the universe. What is the universe? I mean, we wouldn't have science if we didn't have philosophy to begin with. So it's important. And I think that's the point we're trying to push across is this is why Michael is such an instrumental part of the podcast.
Because my influence is seeping in, I can tell. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. Am I doing it right? Am I reading it the way you wanted me to read it?
The cue cards, you're following them perfectly.
The script, perfect.
It's good. I mean, there's a lot of different disciplines that are sort of, people are just gently waking up to the idea that they not only have an interest in this, but also there's room for them to actually say something. I mean, I think, Richard, you were a Cold War historian at first. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Yep. Yeah,
I was. Studied a lot of philosophy, by the way. Very
nice.
Very strong interest of mine. Yes, that always has been. As an undergraduate, I was a maniac. I was for a little while. I was officially a declared triple major. English Lit, History, and Philosophy were my three. And I eventually I thought, all right, the philosophy is too much. So I ended up getting a minor in philosophy, but I did get a dual major in English Lit and History. So I've always loved philosophy. Always.
What were the interests? I mean, were they political philosophy? I mean, I know politics is an interest.
I went into a very unstructured. So I was 18 years old and discovered Friedrich Nietzsche.
Oh, he's the person who I used to have a portrait on him on my desk. Yeah.
Nietzsche's like a strong drink and you better be able to handle it because he's a genius. He's someone that I've come back to many, many times over the years. But no, I got into... really the whole tradition of Western philosophy. I studied a lot of Immanuel Kant, believe it or not, and all the way through from, Aquinas through Descartes and...
so like a broad history of philosophy, sort of. I mean, which makes sense.
Absolutely. So like the good kind of colloquium sort of study.
Yeah.
But then from there, I moved into, for a while, I wanted to be what was called an intellectual historian. So this essentially the history of ideas, so let's leave it there. And I got into what's called historiography, which is the study of history as a discipline, did all of that. And then did a lot of European history, German, did a lot of German history, and then fell into Cold War studies. So by the time I was in my late 20s, early 30s, I was really studying U.S. Cold War history. And it was from there that I discovered the UFO subject. I've talked about it a number of times. But yeah, a little more than 30 years ago, my career goal, nice, delicious, beautiful black hair, big round glasses and a big smile. And I believed in the future and I was going to teach history at a university. That was my goal. And it was going to be Cold War history. I was all about Harry Truman, 1950, outbreak of war in Korea, US national security strategy and so forth. And from there,
I'm so glad you failed in that dream.
It's
a weird thing to say.
Doing that already.
Me too.
It was weird. Told us sometime. I don't want to belabor this, but I was in a bookstore in the very early 90s. It was a kind of a new age bookstore, and it had a UFO book on the shelf. It was by the great Timothy Good, whose classic book Above Top Secret was staring right at me. But it was the subtitle that got my attention, The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up. And I remember flipping through it thinking, this is a pretty good book. Looks pretty good. He's got documents in there. And the thing that was weird for me was that Tim was writing about all of these departments and people that I had studied in my academic work. I recognized many of the names, and I thought, wait, he's got them with flying saucers. Why have I not read about any of this in my academic work? Is this all BS, or is there something here? Really simple. And I bought the book, and I got on what was then the internet at the time. News bulletin boards, you know, people.
Oh, yeah, news boards.
But there was a lot of UFO information there. And I, the next thing I knew, it was a rabbit hole, and I totally became obsessed.
Fascinating. Well, go ahead, Jason.
I was going to say, still to this day, Richard, you hold the title for the best hair in ufology. You know what I mean? Like your hair was
best hair. Renowned.
Best hair.
Wow.
Best hair in ufology. You know, I decided not to compete. I'm going for the mustache instead.
Yeah, you get the mustache award at the
contact. All right. You got you something different. Yeah.
Look, man, I thank you, but this is not the best hair. It's probably like the third or fourth best.
I know, but it's like every time
there's got to be a couple of people out there.
He's got some good brows. Got to say.
Yeah. Well, but like I said,
the eyebrows. Yeah. There we go.
The eyebrows. Yeah.
You do. Yeah.
It's a distinct feature, right? Yeah.
Now that Stanton's gone, I'll take the eyebrow.
We have to be distinct. We have to all have our own looks, right? Be recognizable. Hi, Nick was recognizable. So we're all trying to keep up.
Yeah.
Totally. Great brows. Yeah.
I'm going to grow like a massive mullet. I think that's going to be my look.
That would stand out.
Now that would stand up, right?
Among the people at conferences, I think it would. But on message boards and forums, I think that there's a lot of mullets that are just, you have no chance of competing with.
Well, but this actually leads me to a thought. So both of you are very intellectual people, right? And we're seeing a lot more intellects getting into the subject. You know, scientists like Gary Nolan's coming forward, sure. And he's really dishing it out too. Like he told Tyson Degrassi, whatever his name is, I don't care.
Oh yeah,
he told him off, right? It's about time. Right. It's about time. Totally. You know, saying that, hey, there's so much evidence here that you're throwing out the window because your ego. You know, I'm the go-to guy for science, and he brought up a good point. Hasn't written any papers, hasn't done any science, you know, studies or anything, like nothing of value. Just goes on shows and poo-poos on everybody else's research.
He also basically took a statement that I believe originally was from Bertrand Russell. There's a great philosopher. Russell once said, this is a paraphrase, but he said, a scientist who's engaged in, who uses his scientific expertise for anything other than an objective, dispassionate search for the truth is engaging in a kind of intellectual treason, or something to that effect. That was Bertrand Russell. And that's really what Gary Nolan said about Neil deGrasse Tyson. He essentially stated, look, you're using your position as this very powerful spokesperson for the world of science, but you're not using it in a scientific manner at all. In fact, you're using it purely as the regime spokesperson. That's really what you're doing. And that's intellectual treason. Gary didn't say it that way, but that's essentially what he did say. And that's right.
Yeah, it's a sort of spokesperson for scientific orthodoxy or something, right? Yeah. I mean, and maybe we need that. Maybe we need some sort of authoritative voice where people can go and say, oh, that's what scientists generally believe, but to say it as if it's established and undeniable truth is so problematic. And this is a problem that I have as a philosopher, because philosophers come off inevitably as arrogant because we presume to actually know things that other people of other disciplines don't. But one of the things that I think I know about science as a philosopher is that scientists don't study science. Scientists study things like stars and the mating patterns of birds and how clouds and rocks form.
You say they practice like science, maybe.
They practice science, but who studies? But it leads to the bizarre consequence that scientists can do really great science, but not have a very sophisticated understanding of how science itself actually works as a historical discipline.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of blind spots in there, and people like Neil deGrasse Tyson have those. They don't understand, for instance, that a lot of scientific theories operate using fictional concepts like dark matter, something that have absolutely no observable reality, but they're kind of placeholders or something. And But they present these theories as if they're sort of established fact, just as clearly established as that, like, you know, water freezes at a certain temperature or something. And those just aren't the same thing. Or it's a perpetual frustration of mine as a philosopher.
I just want to say this too. One of the most shocking things to me in my degree was when I did take statistics and I learned more about experiments and the bell curve and how in science, it's regular practice to delete the outliers.
Yes. And I have
never gotten over this because I felt like an outlier my whole life in every area. And when you just think of that, when we're talking about astronomy or UFOs or whatever, the outliers are such an important part of the holistic look viewpoint at everything. I mean, I get why they do a lot of the time, but gosh, when we're talking about stuff like this and we're talking about reality, I don't think we can afford to just delete the outliers, you know? And then I also was so surprised to see that sometimes the sample sizes are so small and that's what is representing the, you know, the greater good. I mean, I walked away going, I need to read, you know, when I see studies, I need to go in and read every single thing about them because people just cherry pick whatever they want out of them.
That's really good.
And I just can't let go of that. It's really, I mean, how often is it actually a true account of our greater reality? I don't know.
Absolutely.
I got to throw that in. The deleting the outliers is just, you know, mind-blowing.
That's an excellent point. I mean, and that happened, I guess the rationale behind that is often that you're assuming that if there's some very strange outlier, it must be a glitch in the data, something went wrong in the study, or you got some weird, you know, by a sample or something. It's an assumption, but that assumption is basically just the assumption that the science that we know really does already represent reality as we assume it does. So anything that deviates from that just must be ignored. But the only way we get really radical scientific change is if those outliers pile up enough to the point that we can't ignore them, and then we have to have some new theory about them. But that's hard to do when, like, as you're saying, a lot of the scientific orthodoxy that we have, especially in psychology, will be based on a study from 1976 that had 36 white kids from Yale as their entire sample size. And that's what's established, for instance, that, like, I don't, you know, whatever scientific orthodox belief we might have. It's bizarre.
Totally. And the scales that they will compare things against were very shocking to me, too. For example, in the psychology of religion, we studied mysticism, and I was blown away by the scales that made people fantasy prone.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, if you consider astrology at all in any way, you're on their fantasy prone list. You know, I was offended by the incredible bias of the scales that people were being measured against.
Like subcategorization, right?
Yes. Yeah. I was completely offended. And I just thought, you know, maybe someday in the future, I'm going to write my own scales and I'm going to submit them. But I need to get deeper into all these fields and understand it more. But I just really could see the narrow-mindedness. And like you said, not always on purpose, right? It's just the nature of how they have to study something. They have to boil things down into one particular question so they can just answer that question. But it's so narrow that it just doesn't leave room for genuine discovery, like you were saying.
Absolutely.
And there was a book published, I think the year I was born, 1962. It's a classic, philosophers know it, Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which he coins the phrase paradigm in that book. And really what Kuhn said is, I mean, speaks to exactly what you're talking about. He says, how does science really progress? Well, you have a scientific consensus, but then there's all this data that's anomalistic, that doesn't quite fit into the consensus. And he's like, you know, if you have one or two of those, maybe you don't have to pay much attention to it. But when those anomalies start building up, it becomes necessary to rethink your paradigm, he'd said. Mm-hmm. So his great example was to go from the physics of Isaac Newton to the physics of Einstein and relativity. He said, look, eventually the anomalies just build up and you had to construct something revolutionary. Mm-hmm. The structure of scientific revolutions is incorporating this anomalistic data, mm-hmm. which, as you were saying, gets weeded out.
Yeah.
And it's, so it still goes on. In other words, what Kuhn wrote over 60 years ago, scientists haven't learned from it. they still practice the exact same way. They still self-censor and eliminate data that does not agree with their paradigm.
And psychology is particularly egregious in some areas, right?
Yeah.
Really, it's hard to have a holistic view of the human, of the person, of someone's psyche, if you're cutting out every single transpersonal aspect beyond the personality. So if people are experiencing lucid dreams, near-death experiences, abductions, whatever. Traditional psychology does not acknowledge that.
You got to understand, we just did a whole consciousness weekend event, which was amazing. Blew my mind. Tracy's way more experienced in this than me, but I'm into it. People are surprised. They're like, Richard, you're supposed to be this objective historian. Yes, indeed. And I love doing history. I love being as objective as I can be, as factually based as possible. But that doesn't mean that I'm not fascinated by non-locality, by transpersonal psychology that you discussed. I'm very interested. We just talked with Russell Targ and Dale Graff. Mm-hmm. Both of these men are 89 years old. Both have had a full lifetime of studying psi phenomena. And I'm just going to tell you, they have gone deep into crazy mm-hmm. things like precognition, retrocausality. What? Retrocausality. And so I'm still at this point where I am trying to reconstruct my reality based on some of the things that they dropped over the weekend. But my point, I guess, and I'll just end it here, is that there is so much, and I am convinced, there's so much of our reality that we have not grasped. And so for us to just put reality into this tiny little box that we're comfortable with is not doing us any favors in the long run, because I think, that prevents us from really going into the really interesting truths that undoubtedly exist all around us.
I would also say it's not just our narrow-minded or dogmatic approach to science, but the omissions as well, because obviously with the UFO phenomenon, the science behind it must be insane. And there's got to be thousands of scientists that have worked for these programs at this point. That know probably stuff on physics and understanding of the universe that we, and I say we as a scientific community at large, have no idea that it even exists. It's not even on our radar. So the omission, even what CERN is up to, like, do we know everything they're up to? Like, certain things get omitted. It, as long as they don't mention it, it's not a lie. It just don't let you know about it. Yeah. And I think we're at that age now where we're like, look, something's not adding up. The technology that we're seeing, the technology that a lot of experiencers are experiencing, is not human. We know it's not human because, like, I'm 42 years old. I have 42 years of experience living amongst humans. That makes me an expert, right? I know what
we're capable of. You've done your 10,000
hours. Yeah, I've done my time. I know what's possible, what's not possible, and what is something that is natural and something that's not natural. I had close encounter when I was a kid, and I tell you, that thing above my head was not natural. It wasn't human. Mm-hmm. And that clicks in. There's like a synchronicity between what happens within and then what's happening outside that clicks in. And you're like, there's something not adding up. And the people not telling us this, it's a crime against humanity, because we should know. I have every right to know what reality is. Well, but there's
case in point. So last summer, I think it was last summer, David Grush talking to Congress. Was it when he said he said this in a private meeting in New York City that leaked out a couple of months ago, David Grush. And he talked about the fact that we have a craft that is 40 feet diameter on the outside, but when you go in, it's like a football field. Now we've heard this many times. Mm-hmm. This is not new. Tracy and I have just recently been reviewing another source where this is alleged, and it's very interesting, but there's quite a bit. Now, if that's true, which I think there's good reason to at least entertain this as true, that this speaks to the question of, like, how strange the physics are, how strange this phenomenon is. There's clearly you get these indications of space-time manipulation in one way or another, space and time manipulation, both. So this phenomenon represents a physical and physics reality that's a real challenge for us. And I'm not saying that's a good reason to keep it secret, by the way, but I would probably imagine it is definitely something that would cause some hesitancy among those who know.
Sure.
I agree with that. Let me just,
Oh, go ahead, please.
What was I going to say? I was just going to say, I agree with that, but something Jason said I wanted to speak back to. Oh, just in terms of validation for people who have experienced something outside of the realms of what they're telling us is normal. I mean, I agree with what Richard's saying, but you can't leave these people thinking they're crazy on the other end. Like, if they can't give it all, I think there could be a way to disclose some things, or just not to, sure. When these things happen to people, they can become untethered because of these things, especially when they become so isolated and they're constantly told in every direction, no, it didn't happen.
Well, I wasn't trying to argue for the secrecy.
I know. I just wanted to just make mention of this on behalf of experiencers who are, you know, spending their lives in isolation, trying to internally reconcile something, and society goes against it. But also a lot of the people who reject it and have not had those experiences reinforce society's position to them, you know, and make it kind of worse. Right.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Yeah. So all I'm trying to do is just leave that wedge open for, there's got to be some middle ground, I think, where we can give some type of help or acknowledgement to the experiencer. And also, I just want to say that the baselines of trauma for experiencers are exactly the same of the baselines for trauma markers for, you know, people who have PTSD from the war, from rape, from horrific things. They have actual trauma where the memory is processed in a different part of the brain, just as it is with any other type of trauma versus regular memories. So
abductees and other people with extraordinary encounter experiences, you're saying, are processing their trauma in the same way that other people process their trauma.
Yeah. So
regardless of what anybody thinks about what actually happened to them, it is as if this really happened in every literal sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So what, we're just going to, you know, leave them behind, you know? So I just like to point that out, you know, in advocating for the experience that it, and just the, I guess, the experience that these people are going through,
And we were actually talking to Sydney Morrison, who is running the Yale student UFO studies, and we're trying to connect. Michael and her are going to connect. We're going to really try to hook her up, because she's trying to push this in Yale as much as possible.
Oh, wow.
But she's an experiencer.
And also from a mental health perspective, too. There's like a mental health dimension to her concern about people's experiences of the phenomena. And Jason and I both have a passion for, you know, mental health struggles and how that interacts with people's experience of even normal everyday reality is difficult for a lot of people. For me, I'm one of those people. Yeah. So encountering something that's truly bizarre has to be even so much more
The evidence is also in their lives. Like they lose their marriages, they lose their kids, they lose their houses. Like, why are we not factoring that in into the whole of what that person is saying? It's not just their story. Watch what happened after their story. Watch the decline of the person or the changes in the person. That should be documented, and we're not doing that. Again, somebody was mentioning the cherry picking of what we want. Yeah. And it's true. I do that too. I work on the abduction and counter mutilations. I love those. I don't know why. Statistic. Maybe. I don't know. But I love those two subjects the most. But I have to look at everything and I have to factor in everything. And what are the effects? And the abductees that I've spoken to, I'm like, I asked them, like, well, what was it like? A lot of people from the 70s are coming forward now saying, hey, in the 70s, you know, 77, 78, huge abduction period in the States, it looks like.
That's right.
I have a guest. We have a guest, Susan Alway, is coming on.
77 flapper in Brazil.
Exactly.
Colares, that's Brazil's northeastern coastline there. Lots of activity. That was a huge, huge year. Some people at the time tried to blame that on the release of Steven Spielberg's movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which came out at the later part of 1977. But I think there's been a lot of work on this, and I strongly have to disagree with that assessment. Well, when you look at the number of UFO sightings, not just abduction or direct experiences, but sightings were off the charts. We're talking military, civilian, and then encounters with beings themselves. Many people in 1978, particularly.
Tracy, maybe you can speak to this. One thing that continuously unnerves me as I learn more and more about this subject is how people will report having a very detailed, clear encounter with something bizarre, and the standard dismissal of it is just something like, the brain is weird, it does weird things. You saw Steven Spielberg's movie, and then there was a rash of sightings. But that's appealing to, there's no mechanism that I know of that's been proposed in psychology by which people see films and then start having really intense hallucinations like entire nations of people do. So it's not like there's, you know, even if that were true, we'd be positing something really bizarre. That is this bizarre psychological mechanism that causes people to just like lose their minds and really like, you know, narrowly constructed ways after seeing a movie or something. I mean, does that ring true with your understanding of psychology, that, or my annoyance at least? Does that ring true for
you? No. I mean, I think it's very logical that some of these things could influence us, but no, I don't think they can go to that level of saying the culture is creating the abduction phenomenon. Like, no way. I think that's ridiculous. And they just don't want to look at it because they don't understand it, you know?
Also, well, I'm thinking of the movie Jaws. So I was a kid when that came out. And it was another Spielberg movie. Mm-hmm. And it was a terrifying movie. Bum, 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 bum. And it did frighten people away from the beaches. Like Jaws, the movie did have this effect.
Yeah.
So people were influenced by the movie. But the thing is, you did not see an uptick in people saying, oh my God, I saw a shark in the water. Like that didn't, mm-hmm. I'm not aware of anything like mm-hmm. that. So there was a fear, but it did not translate into some kind of hallucinatory effect.
Yeah.
So which would speak to perhaps your arguments, both of you.
Yeah, like I still think it's important in my lectures, I talk about people doing honest self-assessments, you know, mm-hmm. of their own psychology, if they are, you know, having experiences. And I do think the work that Gary Nolan's doing right now, where he's looking at the spectrum of, you know, he's very curious, and I love this. He's asking really amazing questions. He's looking more at the spectrum of autism and where that might go off in its extreme form. And the other end of the spectrum with like schizophrenia, multiple personality disorder, and that the extreme of that might be fantasy. Because I mean, we do have to kind of look at the whole spectrum here, and he wants to look and see if there's indicators in the brain and what we can learn, because that is a holistic look at it as well. I mean, there's looking at the brain with this whole spectrum, and then talking to people with their experience of the whole spectrum and putting this whole thing together. And then culture, of course, can influence in a certain way, like Richard was just saying. But, and I guess this does call for, again, a holistic look at everything. But I do think that people could start, to answer your question, I do think people could start dreaming. They could be influenced if they watched Ancient Aliens and the whole thing was on Greys. Could they have a dream about Greys? I do think they could. But I do think there's different sort of markers that researchers know about to kind from all of the patterns to kind of weed out some things, weed out some a little bit of, I mean, let's just be real. There's a little bit of attention seeker, you know, on the whole gamut here, because this field is becoming so popular, there really is there are some people that are attention seeking.
Just Stan Romanek, I'm just saying.
there's some people who are a little bit unstable, right? Yeah. That they just these are real things that happen to people. It's not judgment at all. And so there is a spectrum, and we just need to look at all of it and put it together. But I think where I was going with that was we can tell patterns that are emerging of I don't want to exclude people when I say this, but because of what I said in the beginning about deleting the outliers, but there are patterns emerging that we can sort of glean information, and we could tell a little bit easier if someone was maybe having a dream that was just based off of an ancient alien show that they had.
Wrong interpretation of,
yes.
A state of mind maybe, right?
Yeah, I think there's ways to tell this, but is there sort of a mechanism that we can look at? I don't think so. A long way to...
We gotta use our best judgment in many cases.
Yeah, it is true. So well, I didn't have a great answer for your question. I'm sorry. That was kind of all...
No, I mean, I think you spoke to the complexity of the situation. There's so many enormous variables, entire cultures and worldviews, and like people's, you know, dream lives, and the depth of human psychology is, it just can't be plumbed. So like you, we throw all those things together, and there probably isn't a clear answer to questions about how this phenomena exactly manifests at enormous scales. So thanks for speaking sensitively to it.
I just want to add one thing. Thank you for that. Anthony Peake was at our conference, and he did a lecture and a workshop. He is fascinating. So he looks at this kind of in a different way, more like Jacques Vallée, but he's going off in his own direction. And I think his ideas need to be considered. He is looking at this as one phenomenon, and that the phenomenon is intelligent, and that it will manifest for that person.
We should clarify. So when he says he's looking at this, what I think you mean is paranormal, psi phenomenon, yes, aliens, UFOs, all of these different things.
Yes.
There is a tendency for him to do that. But by the way, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with him on that. But,
I'm not saying one way or the other. I just think it's an important thing for us to have a look at.
Yeah, there's an argument to be made. I was thinking of this recently. So you have a lot of folks who will look at this phenomenon as interdimensional. You have other folks who look at it as extraterrestrial. So for many, many years, I was almost exclusively an extraterrestrial hypothesis guy. I still am predominantly that, to be honest. However, each side has its own biases. So the interdimensionalists, and let's say Anthony's one of those, there's a tendency that they will bring in all of the experiences and say, well, this is interdimensional. I say, well, you know, I look at a lot of these technological cases. I'm doing a very long study book on USOs right now, so water-based UFO phenomenon. And I ask myself, so if an object exits the water and shuts down a United States aircraft carrier for 30 minutes, everything, is that interdimensional?
Depends
that sounds
how,
technological.
Depends how we're defining interdimensional there.
Yeah. But anyway, what I would say is I don't think it's all strictly interdimensional. I think we're dealing with technology, we're dealing with physicality, and so on. So I think it's flawed. But on the other hand, the ET people would look at some of the interdimensional types of evidences and just say, I don't accept that, and they would just push it out. So they wouldn't bring it all in. They would just ignore, right, which I used to do. And so what I've come to feel, and Anthony's, he's very brilliant, it's true. I think actually there's probably both of these are true. I think we're dealing with an extraterrestrial or some kind of physical non-human component. At the same time, they're, you know, space is weird, time is weird, reality is weird, there very likely can be existences out of what we consider this dimension as well. So I'm open to that. And I tend to think that when people have, you know, if you're experiencing a ghost, maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's not an ET. Maybe they're not all related. Mm-hmm. He thinks that they are. I'm still on the fence with that. I think I have different opinions.
I had this idea one time. Remember when I used to talk to you about beta isolation?
Yes.
So this idea is based on the brainwave states. So beta being the one that we're probably in speaking.
Active.
People who are listening would be in a little bit slower state of alpha, and it goes down to theta for deep meditation, and delta is sleep, and gamma, that's a whole other thing I would could go on and on about. But I once wondered, because this is just the electrical system of the brain, but we're perceiving everything through the mind, right, through the brain. And I just wondered, why is it that absolutely everything, like ideas, inspiration, flow state, hypnosis, mediumship, any discipline, any side discipline, even abductions are usually reported when people are driving, when they're dropping down into a state, right? Like a slower state. Beta being this really awake state, why is it that every single thing that possibly happens, just about, it would seem, is when we're out of beta. So I started to wonder, since this is all perceived through the brain, is it possible that that brain state is holding us, just barely holding us into place, where we don't perceive all of these things that are somehow together? Like, I'm not trying to categorize them all as the same. They could all be different. But for some reason, we're designed in this kind of beta isolation. I mean,
yeah, it's like a set of blinders that blocks lots of different kinds of things, but it doesn't mean that they're all
they're
same.
They're beta blockers.
Yeah, beta blockers. And, yeah, right. And could it even explain, maybe, I mean, this, people will probably think this is very oversimplified, but could it even explain why in a crowd, some people would see things and some people won't, right, beside
good
them?
Good point. Good
could
point.
Could they be in a slower sort of oscillating electrical state in their mind? So, I mean, I've been thinking about this for years. The thing about the brain waves is they're usually a whole bunch going on at the same time, but there's mm-hmm. a dominant one, right? So beta is really like the awake for us. Although gamma is a whole mystery too. I don't know whether to bring that
that's
into
another
the
rabbit
discussion.
Hole.
But
you can see this is why I like hanging out with this lady.
Yeah, this is great. You know, this makes me think of the work of Ian McGilchrist, who works on like brain lateralization stuff. He has this fantastic book called The Master and His Emissary, where he argues that not only brain waves, but have this controlling sort of role to play in our mental states, but that the hemispheres attend to the world in very different ways, so that they're both always engaged. It's not like one's doing language and one's doing math or whatever. They're both doing both, but they do it in very, very different ways. And that most of our, what we perceive as our unconscious modes, is this sort of highly active left hemispheric mode that likes to chop the world up into lots of different you know, objects that we can manipulate. And it's also what a lot of meditators in the Eastern tradition would call the monkey mind, which I think is probably also kind of a
phrase that Tracy uses a lot.
Yeah.
It's
hopefully not against you, Richard. That'd be a low blow. Don't ever use it against your spouse.
It's not necessarily bad, but that's, I'm just throwing those.
Oh, no, you're talking about my total passion here. The left-right brain stuff and all of the experimental studies where they cut the corpus callosum and they look at the differences of how the right brain and the left brain work.
You've got two people inside you almost. If you cut
have
the corpus
two people inside you. Yeah, so it's fascinating. Myself and other people, Anthony Peake's one of those people, but lots of different people, we wonder if, bless you, if the right brain is the antenna. You know, remote viewing wonders this. You know, they were looking at this way back when. Well, And the and it also brings up, sorry, Jason, I just want to say this last thing. It also brings up a question of when we have these dreams about abductions, let's just say, we are getting the interpretation from the left. Is it even interpreting closely what's actually happening? Because in remote viewing studies—
Or is it just applying familiar sort of tropes or something, right? Is
yeah,
that the idea
right.
that it's just kind
yeah.
of—
Because like remote viewing studies, early remote viewing studies are perfect for this because they realized early on at Stanford Research Institute that the pictures were accurate, but the words were wrong. When they would do remote viewing. And so they wondered, is this a right brain function? What? Because this hand doesn't, like it's getting it perfect, but the words are all messed up. And, the, you know, so... Even they were, I think, were taken by this interesting part of it. So
the connection there is that the right brain has no voice. It can understand language, but it doesn't express using language. It expresses using imagery and other sort of, non-linguistic forms. So it's kind of hard to draw the distinction between what's a language and what's not, but it doesn't use spoken language in the same way. So that's a fantastic thought. I love that connection. Also, the remote viewing connection now sews back into the Soviet interest that you have, Richard, right? Because that's a whole, backdoor handshake that the Americans and the Soviets had going on with that line of research at the same time. This is fantastic.
Funny, last weekend we were hanging out with Dale Graff, who, as I mentioned, is 89 years old. Dale worked at Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patt back in the 70s, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and he is the guy who wrote probably the most detailed analysis of Soviet psychic research, which was what got the Pentagon in the mid-70s to do its own version of remote viewing for the next 20 years, which Dale ran.
Analysis? Is it a book or is it just a report?
It's a report and it's more than 100 pages long. We have a copy of it. I'm sure it's, I don't know if it's out there or not, but after the program, I'm sure we can forward it to you.
I would love that. We'll put it in the show notes for readers.
He did this on his own initiative at the risk of his career. I mean, he just, he's an intelligence officer and he's looking at the Soviets and he just decided, I want to look at their psychic research. Like, yeah, that's a great career idea, isn't it? But he did it. And it was such an excellent study that it did prompt the Pentagon to go forward with their own version of remote viewing, Project Stargate, which he named. He came up with that name.
I was going to mention, guys, too, amongst the experiencers or in abductees, they all seem to be right brain, like an artistic, very open-minded, compassionate, love animals. I have yet to see a psychopath or a sociopath say that they've been abducted. I've not heard of one yet, but they're all compassionate people. And it's almost like, are they selected or is it that specific type of person that they're interested in?
That is a great observation and question. And I know Grant Cameron is very into this as well, right?
Right.
When he and I first met, we just went crazy on the right-left brain. We were all about it, you know?
Right.
And people wonder that. Are they selected, people who are right brain dominant? Or could it be that maybe it's everybody, but the memories are harder to control in more right brain dominant people who are visual spatial. I call this, just for fun, the messy bedroom brain, because I am off on the right spectrum. I had to draw pictures to learn a lot of things when I was growing up. I'm very high on that level. I had to learn how to work it in a left brain world, you know? So I speak for myself when I say this, but and where I get this from, the idea that my memories never feel linear, unlike Richard's, never.
Right.
They're spread out all over the place like a messy bedroom. But only I can know exactly where those things are. And I just wonder if it's harder to manipulate this type of memory organization in someone who's very dominantly visual spatial.
It's got to be.
As opposed to that's very filed and linear, you would think that would be easier to control.
I think it has to be.
That might be, yeah.
Yeah, if you're left brain, you would dismiss it because it doesn't make logical sense to the way your brain works. But if you're open-minded, right brain, you're like, oh, that happened, right? Like it.
Yeah, you could be open-minded. The memories could be closer to the surface. They could be harder to control. So I have a feeling it probably happens across the scale. But for some reason, people with that are more dominantly on this side can either remember or, you know, that's just my theory. I don't know.
My initial gut reaction was that it would be more difficult to manipulate the memories of a person who has this really rigid structure for how all the memories relate to each other and were organized, because you'd be sort of fighting against their filing system. Whereas I'm a messy bedroom person too, but it's, I read this paper probably 2 years ago that studied artists who and how they organize their spaces. And there's like two very distinct ways. There are people who have cabinets for absolutely everything. And then there's people who have to be able to see all of their tools at the same time to be able to think.
And that's terrible. That's you too?
Oh, absolutely. Like I realized what I'm doing is I'm not a fundamentally messy person. It's just I'm using my space like it's all one gigantic shelf.
Me too.
So I can see where everything hit. I totally get it. But and I need to be able to do that to think creatively. Like materials am I going to grab for this project or whatever? If it's all filed away, I can't even. It's like I have no object.
It's like it's gone something. Forever, right?
Yeah.
Are you a million tabs guy too? I got a million tabs. Because I gotta remember all my thoughts.
I have a great extension for you for the browser that will just take all of your tabs and put them in a neat list that you can. We're gonna be best friends. This is great.
I love this.
In my more mean moments, I would sometimes poke fun at all the tabs that Tracy has open on her computer.
He still does.
I mean, it's around the edges a little bit.
There. But hey, I embrace this about myself more now.
You like your tabs.
Fine, it's worked for you. Just go with it. You're not crazy. But if you lived in nature, nature is one gigantic shelf. There are no drawers out in nature. Yeah. So we evolved to live in a world that hasn't chopped everything up into nice little pieces that we can kind of stow away and manipulate. Absolutely. So there's an advantage to it, though. I mean, the advantage to get it diminishes the more we live in this sort of left brain world. But
I agree. But Jason, it was a great question.
Oh wow!
I don't know the answer, but I really think that's a great question.
Well, even we're talking about the dumbing down almost of the beta state, and the thing is, Joe Rogan recently was talking on his podcast about he thinks it only happens at night when people are sleeping or they're sleepy behind the wheel, and I beg to differ because this happens in broad daylight and you're fully awake. But everybody says there's like a dumbing down of their state of mind. Where they're just compliant, and it's the way I could only understand is in 2017, I was in a bad car accident. I was taking a sip of coffee, put my coffee down, and we got hit. Now, I felt everything, but my brain visually did not keep up with the feeling of what was happening. It was sending it to me in chopping blocks. I remember the accident. I remember certain scenes, but a lot of it is not computed because I think maybe the left brain kicks in at that point. And that's all you can remember. And I think, maybe these experiences are so traumatic that it's similar to a car crash. They see the clips the same way the brain did for me in the accident. Even though their physicality, something went far beyond those clips. So I think maybe part of the experience or the phenomenon is something like that. And it's frustrating because we can't reproduce it. Like a scientific experiment, you could reproduce the conditions with these buggers, you can't. And it's frustrating. And I think we have a very hard field to study because there's a a trickster aspect to it. And just before we leave, what are your thoughts on that?
The trickster element in our reality? I'll just back up a little bit and describe what I think reality is these days. I believe that we are dealing with an actual physical group of beings that come from some other place that have a very strong interest in our world and in us as a species. And I think at the same time that there is what I sometimes call a meta intelligence or something that is operating above us in a way that's just vastly beyond any kind of human or alien intelligence that I can think of. I actually think both of these exist. So you can call that a spiritual dimension, what ancient people would have called a spiritual dimension, what we can now call, They live in some other kind of dimensionality. Maybe quantum physics can factor its way in there somehow. I don't know.
Like the source, right? The source.
There's some. Yeah. I tend to believe in. I guess I could say I believe in God, however I can understand what that is, a kind of pervading intelligence that is all around us, a field. Hmm. And I think that field is of an intelligence level that I can't even comprehend. So I think that's there. So the trickster part of it, though, I mean, there have been a number of instances where UFO researchers have done detailed studies of this phenomenon going back many decades. There was a guy back in the early 80s named Harlan Smith, something like that. Project Identification was his book. He was a professor in Missouri who took his grad students. He was a skeptic on UFOs, and they did outdoor studies of UFOs. And he quickly came to realize that this phenomenon was anticipating him. It was prescient. It was vastly beyond. It seemed to be playing games with them. You hear people like Dr. Eric Davis say this exact same thing about the phenomenon, that it's prescient, that it's messing with us at times. You know, Eric Davis was over at the Skinwalker Ranch for years, so he had a really good deep dive into that whole phenomenon. So there could be a real trickster element to our reality. The thing is, I don't think we've only as a species graduated to a certain level of awareness of our world. And so we're now finding ourselves encountering maybe extraterrestrials and maybe interdimensionals as well. And do we really know the full landscape of both of those worlds? Do we know how the interactions are between and among those different groups? Not really. It's like going to a ball game and you don't have the scorecard of the teams. We don't really know all the players yet. And so we need to do a lot more research and figure that out. But to answer the question about a trickster, yeah, I would not be surprised at all. You hear about a hitchhiker effect, people coming back from Skinwalker Ranch being followed by some kind of phenomena. Maybe that's partly a trickster. I don't know. I would just say that I think that there are genuine mysteries to this reality that we find ourselves in, both in the physical realm, dealing with UFOs and ETs, as well as a dimensional realm, dealing with what we might call a spirit world or things like that. A lot we don't know.
Hear, hear.
Nicely said. Tracy.
I just couldn't agree more. I mean, we do our best to figure it out, but we just really don't know. Mm. I think that's one of the most difficult things for me when I see a lot of people out there claiming that they know in an absolute way. And I thought, how can we possibly know? I mean, yeah. This is, we're doing our best, but there's just so many aspects to account for. It is virtually impossible to come to a solid absolutist, well, you know,
in this day and age, for sure.
About it. I mean, yeah. So
I would like to add one thing, which is, when I look at the physical UFO, UAP phenomenon, leaving out the interdimensional, leaving out the trickster part of it, the actual physical interactions that people are having with what appear to be craft, which happens a lot. It happens all around the world every day. Every day. There are good reports, cases. Yes, they can be raw reports, not fully investigated, I understand. But when you read enough of them, as I've done, I've read thousands and thousands of them, you start to think there's a real pattern here. And I think you can develop a sense of the reality and the legitimacy, too. When you do that, it becomes clear that there's something very, very important going on in this world that is important to those beings doing this. They've invested a lot of their time or their energy or their equivalent of money or whatever it is to blanket our world right now, over the oceans, over the mountains, over the cities, over your neighborhood at 2:30 in the morning at altitudes of 200 feet, hanging out, doing God knows what. Why? What is happening that's so important for them? Are they abducting people? If so, why and what are they doing? Are there any other plans? And I'm not even saying that it's necessarily nefarious, but could it be? Could it be for our interests, or could it be against our interests as a species? Could be either.
Or could it be well-meaning?
Well-meaning?
You know, like...
Yeah.
It could be. All of these, but this is what... This is such a, to me, such a massive phenomenon that even now in an era where our media is discussing this more and more, we are really at the baby steps level of conversation publicly on really discussing the implications and the importance and potential gravity of what's happening. Think of it this way. We're in a world that's right now in the middle of a genuine revolution. No one calls it that. But it's a revolution. It's essentially directed, I would call it a globalist revolution. That's real. You have international coordination of politicians, of corporate financial institutions, of ideas, of consistency of propaganda, state-sponsored propaganda over the people, all of that. We all see it. We went through it with COVID and it hasn't ended.
I live in Canada. I live it.
So, that's right. Yeah. We watch your government horrifically destroy those truckers.
Yeah.
That's an unforgivable crime against citizens.
Absolutely.
But that's one aspect of this greater thing. And I'm bringing it up for this reason. The world is going through a massive social, technological, intellectual, political, financial, workplace revolution where, you know, people are losing jobs, all of that. We're transforming into a post-human, transhumanist, whatever the hell this is going to become. At the same time that this presumably non-human intelligence blankets our globe, is there a relationship? Should we be asking? Do these other beings have an opinion on what we are going through? I mean, we've existed as a species, I mean, literally for more than a million, I mean, as standing up apes without body hair, 1 to 2 million years, developing language, all of that. Like, we've been human for a while. We've lived in a certain way. Now we've developed civilization, writing, technology. Yeah. But the transformation we're going through now, there's nothing like this that we've ever gone through. And it's rapid and it's dramatic. And we need to understand this. And at the same time, these others are here. And I can't help but think, are we on the trajectory to become like them? Hive mind, singular consciousness, and maybe all the other things that go along with it. That might be a good thing, or that may not be something that I want to sign on for.
I'd be willing to listen important. To them. I'm all ears. We tried it our way. It doesn't work, right? Yeah. It does not work. I'm all ears.
Yeah. Maybe not.
Yeah.
But the point is, this is the discussion that our society must have.
Right. You brought some really good points there, Richard. And that's the point that we're at right now. It's very confusing. We're almost on the edge of war. Canada's, you know, we're fighting here for our rights. In the States, it's almost on the border of civil war. It's bad. And globally, now everybody's trying to pick a fight. Everybody's drunk at the bar. Everybody's trying to pick a fight, and it's not looking good. And in the meantime, we're trying to fight for advocacy of them saying, "Hey, tell us that we have visitors." Yeah. It's hard. It's a very hard time. But the fact that you guys, like, even I know today you guys got 3 interviews, but the fact that you guys are so consistent and tenacious enough to keep at this, my hat's off to you, because I would have given up years ago. I was telling Michael, I'm like, we were on a phone call before this, and I said, you know, they got 3 interviews today. I'm like, I need my time. I'll do 2 interviews, but after that, I need to read. I need to chill. These guys are like, nah.
We love what we do. Going.
Yeah.
We love it.
It helps that there's 2 of us, because we really, throughout the day, we keep each other going with this.
That's good.
This has been the craziest, busiest January we have ever had. Yeah. You know, where things are stacking like this.
That's good. That means momentum.
Glad we could be part of it. Thank you for taking the time for that.
That's true. Thank you guys, too.
Yeah, before we leave, I always have a sort of final question that I ask, and that is, what books would you recommend to our audience to help them understand the phenomena or the area that you work on in the way that you do, the things that will sort of be the most explosive books that you could push into someone's hands?
Well, I'll just jump in. I feel like I wrote such a book. it was my intention. For someone who is, let's say, a reasonably open-minded, skeptical kind of person relating to UFOs, I would say I wrote a book called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, exactly for that kind of a person. Mm-hmm. It was my attempt to do a kind of one-stop shopping, everything, what's important about the UFO subject that you need to know. So in that book, I dealt with philosophical and scientific issues. I dealt with the historical development of the UFO subject. I delved into the development of ufology, how we've come to understand this over time. I've looked into the crazy science that's actually not so crazy when you get into it, of how these objects might do what they do. And I tried looking at the future. So, and dealing with, you know, contact, abduction and contact and things like this. I tried to look at it all in a way that is not intimidating for a new person, but deals with a lot of meaty issues. So I would say read my book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. It's a good place to start. A lot of other great UFO books that have been written, many, many great ones. And Above Top Secret by Tim Good was the one that got me going. That's a book that was written in the 80s. That's a very fine book, and there's many others.
I would say, yeah, it's interesting because we all are interested in slightly different aspects that interest us, right? And so one of my sort of, I mean, there's so many different books, and I probably my highest interest is in the abduction area. But even beyond that, and what my lectures are about, what everything I believe in is about, is learning to explore our own minds and what we are capable of. I feel like we all have the truncated version, yet we have these odd premonitions or precognitions or synchronicities or deja vus. We have all these little clues, these little breadcrumbs around, but we don't know who we really are and what our brains are capable of. And so when people are exploring remote viewing, if they're interested in the mind, this is me, there's many different books you can go to, but I'll just say, I'm going to answer this a little differently. The one that I'm really into right now is actually one of Dale Graff's books. Mm. I love the remote viewing books. I love the abduction books. But the thing about that I've learned about Dale Graff since we have spent some time with him now is if you are on the personal journey of opening up your mind and exploring and wanting to know how to gently push the boundaries, this is Dale's whole world.
So which is the book you're referring to?
Well, there's two. He's got, they're out of print, but they're still out there. one of them is called River Dreams. And one, this is the other one.
Bring that closer.
Psychic Tracks in the Wilderness. Tracks in the Psychic Wilderness. So this is
nice.
One. Okay. River Dreams is his favorite. I'm kind of digging into both of them at the same time because that's part of our right brain messy bedroom thing, right? I got both of them going on and
multiple books at once. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. With post-it notes.
You can't just read one book at once. What's the point?
Yeah, exactly.
Two hands. Yeah.
But I love it that Dale was a part of this program, running this project for all these years. Yet beyond that, River Dreams is his approach is like an approach to nature. It's like the inner tracks. He's looking for the inner tracks of the psychic realms. He's following the trails. He's such a pioneer in that way. And so in his books, he has these beautiful ways of encouraging people to explore their own minds and find their own psychic tracks. You know, find the breadcrumbs. If it seems like there's nothing there and we have, you know, you could explore mediumship or psychometry or this or that. Dale's kind of opening up a gentler, natural way to claim this back and find out things you didn't even think of that you can do. So that's my take on it.
I love that suggestion. I mean, and what could the UFO UAP community use more than a gentler sort of emotionally mature approach to these interests? I love that suggestion. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It's always awesome to talk. Richard, it's the second time and it's first time for you, Tracy. But seriously, the Dolans are always welcome here on this podcast. And anything we can do to help you guys out, promote anything, we will. By the way, do you guys, we just had an event that this weekend, but do you have anything else coming up that you want to promote?
Not at the moment. I think down the road, like every now and then, these little online conferences we do, we're starting to get the rhythm of it. So they're working out pretty nicely. I will definitely be hosting one or possibly two this year. I definitely want to do one on UAP crash retrievals.
Nice.
I've got a number of folks that I will want to invite for that. And we can do a deep dive into that phenomenon, which I'm very, very engaged in. So we'll see, but I'm sure. Right now, look, my main thing is I've got a big, big book to finish on a water-based UFO phenomena, USOs. And it's,
percentage-wise, how close are you to being done?
Oh, we're in the high 90 percentiles.
Nice. You're almost there. Fact,
yeah. I've got more than 500 cases, I believe. And there's more that I can include, but you have to end it at some point. So that's been the last 2 years, and it's been beyond fascinating. It's in the realm of mind-blowing, the cases I've come up with. They've been scattered all over the place, like a couple of websites here, a couple of books there. They haven't really been gathered together, and they haven't been, in my view, systematically analyzed and described and sort of told in a way that brings them back to life. And that's really what I'm trying to do. So that's my biggest thing.
It's brilliant too, because it needs to be addressed, and there's not enough people addressing it. Plus, mm-hmm. we call this planet Earth when it's mostly water. Just goes to show how stupid we are.
71% of our surface is water, and but we're all landlubbers. We live on land most of the time, yeah. And we're not aware. But there's, and it's not like there's a tremendous number of recorded USO cases compared with normal aerial phenomena. It's a small subset, but it is an important, fascinating subset.
But that's also got to be due to our technology and the amount of sensors that we have that are, air based as opposed to underwater. So I'm sure that
the ones that are underwater are often U.S. Navy and very duly classified. So the information doesn't come out. So that's a big part of the problem too. I mean, most people are not out there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but the U.S. Navy is. But they classify the information they get.
And the big rivers as well, right? I mean, Buddy Hawkins had that case where that lady gets taken and then it goes into the river. Calvin Parker and Charlie Sexton went into the river.
Oh, yeah.
So they do that. They use the waterways. That's a great
rivers,
way not to be
reservoirs,
seen.
Reservoirs, lakes, absolutely. And oceans. And that's right. Large and small bodies of water.
That is scary how much probably activity takes place right now as we're speaking.
We were talking about in BC, and Tracy mentioned Kelowna, the town. I have a number of cases from Kelowna, BC, British Columbia.
Yeah.
Forget the name of the river they have out there, but it's anyway, there's a lot. British Columbia has got quite
very
a bit. I mean, there's infinite little bodies of water and lakes in Canada.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of cases up there.
Yeah, and interestingly, it's the same almost for American viewers and people from across the world. The Kelowna area is very similar landscape to that of the Nevada range of mountains. Mm. It leaks into British Columbia. So it's a desert. We have rattlesnakes in that region. So it's very interesting that there's a lot of activity there too. In my region, Fraser Valley, we have black triangles and a lot of them. And they're seen five at a time in Surrey to Hope. You probably heard about that already, Tracy.
Lots of black triangles out there. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
And Washington State too. So I'm guessing the Cascade Mountains have something to do with it. I don't know why, but
longstanding connection, speculation about Boeing, because they have their Seattle headquarters there. And there were a number of black triangle cases connected with Boeing Field back in the early 90s. I'm aware of, but there's stuff that's been seen coming out of the water out by, Vancouver Island and that whole region.
It's freaky.
There's a lot going on out there.
Yeah,
there's
a
lot a
famous
of
famous abduction
activity.
Case too. Yeah.
You got US and Canadian Navy, so you have to factor that in too, but a lot of strange things happening out there.
Attention.